Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Recovery Talk, a podcast from the Peer Recovery Center of Excellence. I'm your host, Shannon Roberts. Each month, we will be talking with an expert in the field, discussing substance use challenges, resources to assist individuals with a substance use challenge and/or their families, and best practices for the delivery of peer recovery support services. This month, we are bringing you six new episodes. In late 2022, Tim Sobers, who leads our workforce development team, hosted a six-month skill development series for peer recovery support specialists. The training series provided recurring opportunities for peer recovery support specialists from across the country to build foundational skills that are necessary for effective peer support service provision. The series was so well attended and in demand that we also offered it in early 2023. In this podcast series, Tim sits down to have a conversation with each of the facilitators to have a deeper discussion with them about their presentation and what it means for the field. In this fifth episode of the series, Tim spoke with Mux Yaffa about building advocacy skills. Mux Yaffa is an award-winning disabled, MAD, trans, queer, Muslim, indigenous, Palestinian. Mux Yaffa conducts transformative work around displacement, decolonization, equity, and centering lived experiences of individuals most impacted by injustice. Mux Yaffa has worked in over two dozen countries and specializes in global and community vision building. Mux Yaffa is an engineer with a specialty in sustainability and social engineering, a peer support specialist, and an equity and transformation consultant. Without further ado, let's get talking.
Hi, Yaffa. It's good to see you again. I'm excited to be chatting with you today.
All right, so good to see you.
Well, I appreciate your involvement in the skill development series. You were facilitating the topic about building advocacy skills, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about I was going to say what drew you to that topic, but the answer is that I asked you to do that. why you feel like maybe that's a valuable skill for the workforce to continue to build?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for me, building advocacy skills is just important in every profession and in every workforce, regardless of whether it's peer support or any other. As you know, I have a lot of different hats and a lot of different backgrounds and different career paths that I've had. And it's just critical in all of them, right? And even outside of workforces, even just within like family dynamics, right? And relationships and friendships, and just literally every single interaction requires advocacy skills. And so I guess to answer your early question of like what would have drawn me into this topic, right, years and years and years ago, is really just how multifaceted it is and how critical it is as a foundation, as a foundational piece for just everything that we are. And a lot of my work and just the things that I'm kind of drawn to are really in the foundation building of just everything that we are. And I find that because they're so foundational, it just means they apply everywhere in every workforce and every relationship and interaction.
Yeah, I think that's really true. Something that we heard when I was putting the skill development series together was that people felt like they weren't getting enough training in advocacy in their certification trainings. The six topics that we picked were, they came from the workforce saying we don't have enough of these skills. And you had presented sort of a three-tiered advocacy approach of ways that people could do advocacy. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about kind of that model.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely agree of that. I find most trainings don't really cover this topic as much as I would like for us to. And also, I think it's one of those topics that I think just needs to be revisited throughout a person's career. So even if training does get it right from the very beginning, it's something that we need to constantly be checking in on, right, and constantly developing, because the advocacy sphere is also kind of changing, even though it's just a fundamental part, again, of that foundation that we're talking about. And so for me, I kind of break down advocacy into three different buckets. So there's system change, system transformation, and building alternative systems. And for me, it's just kind of a simple way to really allow people to kind of figure out what they want their role to be. And so I break it down into those three different modalities. And I find that that's just an easy way for folks to really figure out where they want to play a role within the advocacy sphere, and then also kind of figure out their roles and responsibilities outside of the spheres that they're a part of. And so I'll define like system change as being a part of a system and then slowly making different changes along the way. It's not going to be transformative. So the entire system itself is not going to completely shift and become something completely different. But it's something that we could be doing every day. And so examples of that would be if something happens with a peer and a peer support specialist wants to go to their supervisor and advocate for that peer, right? Or work with other clinicians within the team and advocate for the peer. All of those would be system change. And even when we get a little bit more into the policy level in the smaller changes category, that a lot of that would also be system change, where we're just kind of, to me, system change is very much like band-aiding, like using bandages on different things. And so you're not necessarily going to eliminate the problem entirely. You might eliminate it for yourself in the role that you're in, with things like boundary setting and things like that, right? So if your supervisor is asking you to do 14 hours, but you're actually only legally supposed to be doing 8, and you go and you're like, hey, actually, I will only do 8, right? Like, there's a lot of advocacy there. And also, that doesn't necessarily mean that the next person in your role is not going to be asked to do 14 hours as well. System change is still absolutely critical because we're dealing with these challenges every single day, right? It's crisis after crisis after crisis. And so when we're thinking of some of the larger things like system transformation, building alternative systems, we might not always have the ability to do system transformation today, but utilizing system change could be really helpful in the meantime. And so that would be system change. System transformation is kind of the higher level of that, which is really dismantling the system in its entirety, right? So by the end of system transformation, the system itself should look very different. And so going back into that example of being asked to work 14 hours a day, that would require to go into the foundation of what allowed that to happen in the first place, and then really doing the work to eliminate that part of the foundation or rebuilding it so that nobody is ever asked to do that kind of labor again. It's usually not just specific to one thing, because transformation is also kind of contagious and it kind of does a domino effect, right? And so if you figure out how to fix that part, right, where no one's going to be asked to do 14 hours, you'll realize that actually you've also impacted the type of role and responsibility now peer support specialists might have, right, and everybody on the team might have. It's going to change how pay it could potentially be their time off. All these different things, and all of a sudden the entire place looks completely different. So system transformation is always really interesting for me, because oftentimes we assume that one takes the longest. For me, though, as a person who predominantly does system transformation, building alternative systems, it's actually false. It's just the resistance to transformation takes up a lot of time. Transformation itself is actually really, really easy and really, really quick, actually a lot quicker than system change itself. But the resistance to it, and for me, being able to name that goes a long way, just for like my own nervous system, right? Where I really make sure that whenever I hear the word transformation, I want a really positive response from my nervous system versus this really overwhelming and like powerless and hopeless response that might come with the word if we include the resistance piece as part of that transformation. And then lastly, we have the building alternative systems, which is just building something completely brand new. You could utilize some of the resources that currently exist within various systems, but the purpose of it is that it should never look like the existing system. And oftentimes it's really the most marginalized of the most marginalized that are creating these alternative systems, because there is no space for us in those systems to begin with, right? And so thinking of something like peer support historically at the very, 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 very beginning was an alternative system, right? There was no space for us to really be within a lot of these spaces. And over time, this alternative system assimilated into the larger behavioral health system within the larger medical industrial complex. And I always share that as an example because it's also really important to to recognize that just because we built an alternative system doesn't mean that it will always be an alternative system, and that it's always going to be free of the challenges that exist within the larger system. And so with like peer support, now we need a lot more system transformation and system change on a daily basis. And also there's room for building alternative systems. And I always say, of like, all three are really critical. It's not one is more important than others. Oftentimes whenever people hear those, they'll hear maybe transformation is better than change, or maybe building alternative systems is better than being within the system itself. There's no real way to really quantify that, whether that's true or not, simply because all three are absolutely necessary. Like, we have the system we have today, right? The question becomes like, well, what do people do today until like 5 p.m. while they're at work, right? What do they do this week? I love building alternative systems, and also the amount of resources that exist within the current systems is so enormous, right? Like, for us to go and replicate that entirely, right, and build something that serves as many people is just a lot, right? And so you need all three. And I find that for me, it's really important for all three to collaborate. And so, like I mentioned, of like, I do a little bit more system transformation, building alternative systems work, more recently, more building alternative systems work, but I'll kind of go back and forth between the three. However, that doesn't mean I don't support people who are doing the system change work. I try to find as many pathways to really support individuals who are in the system, who are trying to make it move along little by little every single day, because I find that's also really critical. And also there are things that I can do in building alternative systems that a person within system change might not be able to do, and vice versa. Right. And so really making sure that we're partnering along the way and making sure that we're moving in the same direction, you know, versus me being like, well, I build alternative systems and y'all are stuck in the system, so good luck. Right. That to me defeats the purpose.
Yeah, and that's something that I hear fairly regularly, is this kind of idea of like one is better than the other. You know, there's often shaming of folks who decide to go work within systems. I myself have faced a fairly extensive questioning of like, why are you working for a federally funded program? You're not really transforming systems because you're taking money from the federal government. And then you have other folks who, like you, can kind of see the broader picture of how all of these pieces fit together. Something that I really appreciate that you talk about, and I'd love for you to kind of just speak on it for a little bit, is the idea of kind of visioning what we'd like to see, visioning kind of utopia is the language that I've heard you use before, and not necessarily in opposition to, but where we often see the focus is advocating against things. This is what we don't like. This is what we don't want to see. And if you kind of question folks like, well, what would you like to see instead? They sometimes struggle to be able to articulate what that new system that you're talking about actually might look like. And so I would love to hear you talk just a little bit more about kind of the importance of envisioning utopia as kind of centering what we want to do.
Yes, I appreciate you bringing that up. That's one of my favorite topics, especially over these last like few years. Although utopia building has kind of been just a part of like my entire life, I was really fortunate where I grew up in a community that did a lot of that work, right? And would utilize that kind of language, and even just ancestrally and things like that. And so really appreciate you asking that. And you're absolutely right. One thing that I've kind of been trying to do in a lot of spaces that I'm in is really reframing different concepts as practices versus just as these, like as emotions, right? Or different actions to be taken. So things like hope, like choice, like vision building. To me, all of those are practices, right? And so it's kind of similar to like trying to work out, right? And building muscle mass and things like that. You're literally training parts of your brain to be able to do it easier over a period of time. And that's kind of one of the reasons that whenever vision building kind of comes up, or asking folks like, what do you want to see, right? Like, what would it look like 20 years from now? What does it look like even a year from now? What would be an ideal situation, or what would happen if something wasn't necessarily the way that it is? It's really difficult for folks because we've never really invested in that muscle, right? To really be able to just move into vision building really easily. And so it's a practice that needs to be honored and needs to be practiced. Right. And I find for whether it's this topic in building advocacy or anything else, it's always really, really, really critical to really understand what are we working towards? Right. To me, otherwise, we're potentially just going around in circles and potentially going to rebuild the same systems that we're saying that we are against. Right. It doesn't make sense to try to transform systems when we're just going to build the exact same one, right? Or build alternative systems. And I hear that often where, you know, whenever I'll talk to individuals, the first thought that they'll have is usually, well, I'm going to go and build a nonprofit. And that's wonderful that folks are like really motivated and inspired to do different things. And also, nonprofits are not very different than the rest of the medical industrial complex, right? Unless we're really careful. And this is coming from me as a person who's like founded a couple of different nonprofits, right? Where it could be very much the same legacy of the same system, or it could be very, very different. And it's really vision building to me that allows us to always be mindful of that and always recognize whether or not we're kind of moving towards those different things that are just going to, again, replicate that system. Whenever you build an alternative system, everything within the existing system will basically be trying to pull you into the existing system, right? And so whether it's funding, whether it's the types of individuals involved, whether it's certifications, whether it's different government restrictions, whatever it is, all of it will be present. All of it is going to happen, right? And so without really knowing where am I heading towards, it really makes it really difficult to stay the course, right? And not have it be hijacked in different ways. And also for me, especially with a topic like this and similar with like hope and with justice and just with everything else, right? Is part of where I usually go is, okay, cool. So we're building advocacy skills. Let's talk about why do we need these advocacy skills in the first place, right? So let's talk about all of the systemic things that exist that make it absolutely necessary for our survival in any of these roles and any of these pathways to be advocating 100% of the time. And also, let's think about building utopia, right? So if we're in an ideal society, is there space for advocacy skills, right? If we remove all these systemic stuff, right? And what happens to advocacy then? And I think that builds a really interesting conversation because advocacy skills are important in utopia. It's not as if in utopia, like we never need to advocate. Like everyone is just going to be honored 100% of the time and everyone's going to know everything that you want to happen and all. Like, no, like, everything is still going to be necessary in terms of relationship building. And so that really allows people to kind of, for me, I find that a lot of times we think about so many different things, specifically different practices as just responses, versus as an investment for us to know how to do it when we do get into that world and building utopia today. Because the framework that I use for building utopia is that we get to live utopia every day, right? That's how you build utopia, is that you live utopia and then the people around you begin living utopia and then their people begin living utopia and so on and so forth. And then until there's a critical mass and then utopia happens. It's not a one-time thing. And actually one of my favorite quotes from Audre Lorde, and I may be quoting this, but she basically says that the revolution is not a one-time event. And to me, it's the same thing with building utopia, is that it's a daily practice. It's not a single destination, but it's that practice that leads to that destination. But all of it is a practice, right? Little by little, as we're doing this more and more of this work, we're able to make it easier for our brains to really get to those places that it needs to go, that makes it so much easier to be in any situation envisioning utopia. And that's beautiful once people like get to that, where it's not this difficult thing, but it starts out difficult because we've never practiced it. Again, it's like you're, I don't know, like lifting 200 pounds or something. I haven't been to the gym in a really long time, but so like, I don't know how much 200 pounds is, but like, imagine if like somebody just did that randomly without any training or something. I don't know if 200 is a lot. Is that a lot? Who knows? But anyways.
You're asking the wrong person.
But anyways, right? And so you're doing like the heavy lifting right off the bat. It doesn't work. Like you're going to be sore after. And it's the same way with vision building. It's the same way with hope. It's the same way with choices. It's the same way with all of these different things. But little by little, it becomes easier and easier and easier until you're in a place where it's just the norm.
Yeah, I love that. I remember you did a community of practice for us last year that was specifically focused on building utopia. And I remember walking away from it being like, wow, this is exactly what I needed to hear. And just like really appreciating that concept. Kind of within that and within advocacy, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on kind of how do we balance what I individually need for myself to have a life of meaning and value that I want to advocate for with what the larger scale communities that I'm a part of are saying that they want and need. And they might sometimes be in tension with each other and they're sometimes in perfect alignment. How do we balance out advocating not just for ourselves, but for the community? And specifically, I know this is a very long-winded question, but I also think of it through the lens of the peer workforces. I want to advocate for myself to be able to grow professionally, maybe build skills, maybe be promoted, but I don't want to leave the rest of the workforce behind either. So within our careers, how are we advocating as a collective, you know, as opposed to centering the next step on my career ladder or moving up that corporate ladder?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Yeah, I think for me, and again, this goes into so many different professions, right? As also like a birthing worker and death doula, it's literally the same conversation. And for me, that's a conversation around like the responsibility that we each have to the larger field, right? And the larger community that we're a part of, which I think, and part of this goes back to that training, right? Part of it goes into just the sustainment of how we're in these roles and how we integrate. But for me, that really speaks to like the responsibility that we each have to one another as being a part of this space. With that said, it is really difficult being in a field where the vast majority of people are severely, severely underpaid, right? And their survival is not accounted for on a daily basis. And so I'm always kind of cognizant of that as well, right? Of this is a difficult field to be in well, now, let me rephrase that. It doesn't have to be a difficult field to be in. We just make it really difficult to be in, again, because of those external factors and the resistance that happens and how our job descriptions could be very, very different than what's actually just very human to us. And so to add the responsibility layer to all of that, I think becomes really, really overwhelming. And so I always try to think of also of like, well, what additional resources do we need, right? What do we need to have in place? Because if like, let's say I'm working in like the state of Pennsylvania and I'm making $8.50 an hour as a peer support specialist, and I want to advocate for something that I know is going to be really harmful for the entire community, not just myself, and now I'm out of a job, right? Like, who do I go to, right? Who do I turn to? And that's where I always go into like really trying to build infrastructure. And we have a little bit of infrastructure as a peer support community, but it's very, very spread out and not very cohesive. Trying to find the best words there, but we definitely have a lot of work to do in terms of building that infrastructure. And that's an area of work that I think, in my opinion, we haven't really invested as much as I would like to see us invest in. And it goes back to that vision building, right? Of we don't necessarily have a shared vision of where peer support is meant to go anymore. And then also there's kind of this terror to really separate peer support as different things within different frameworks in different places, right? So a lot of the places that I'll be in, a lot of the conversations will try to pretend as if like everything is valid and all frameworks are valid and everyone is right. And I'm like, no, excuse me, everybody is wrong. Like everybody, like I could also be wrong. Like we could all be wrong. There has to be some kind of structure, right? And to me, that's that infrastructure. And it's not a national certification, right? It's not It's not a lot of the things that have taken up a lot of our space over the last 10 years or so. But it's really building that base, right? Where we're able to kind of support one another. We're able to show up for one another. We're able to own our workforce, right? Which right now we don't really own our workforce, right? Most of our workforce exists within within other clinical spaces in particular. They're not peer-run spaces to begin with, right? And so so to me, I always go back to that of like really trying to balance the individual responsibility and then also that greater responsibility that we have together as a field, right, to really build that infrastructure. And I will add to that of also with the community piece, this is another area of frustration. And again, where I will tell everyone that they are wrong. I just enjoy telling people they're wrong. It's fun. Where we want to pretend as if we're all one community, right? And we're not, right? Just because a person's a peer support specialist, and I'm a peer support specialist, does not necessarily mean that we are in community. We could be, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we are, right? I'm a displaced Indigenous Palestinian, a queer trans, lots of other things, peer support specialist, right? And without really an understanding of what those identities mean and entail beyond just my experiences with substances and mental health challenges, we're not really part of the same community. right? To me, community means that we can hold each other, right? It doesn't necessarily mean safety, right? Safety is kind of I don't really believe in the concept of safety, right? Because we're all so complex and so unique, and all of our experiences are going to be different. And so the things that make us safe are always going to be transforming and changing and just everything. But to be held within a community, right? Versus denied and being resisted against and having people not show up for that. And so I think for me, there is also that deeper layer of how are we showing up for community that's not really community yet, right? That we want to have within this larger bubble of peer support specialists. But how do we make sure that the bubble of peer support specialists is actually really safe? Well, back to the word safe, right? But is able to really hold people, right? Like that it could be a space of belonging for everyone involved. And that's not the case currently, right? Which is why you have a lot of a lot of the alternative pathways to peer support, right, are the alternative systems that are being built are specifically by the most marginalized of the most marginalized, right? And so you have BIPOC trans spaces that have their own peer support spaces and networks, and Muslim queer and trans spaces, and the list goes on and on. But it's and Black spaces, right? But how do we have those conversations to really make sure that that wider community, which is predominantly white, cis, and straight, right? How do we make sure that there is space for other folks? And that's a different layer of responsibility that exists for every single individual, depending on the identities that they have. So, like for me personally, as a non-Black person, I view that as my role to really make sure that I'm also making space for Black folks wherever I am. And so, for white individuals, that could be for all BIPOC folks, for or the global majority folks, right? For cis people, for to build space for trans people. And in my head, so when I started peer support years ago, about like 10 years ago, I was constantly going around to everyone and being like, oh my God, peer support is the answer, right? Like, because in my head, I was like, how could you do peer support and not really get equity? Like, to me, the like you they just you, I was like, what, how? Like, and I've been very impressed over the years of how you could you could be a peer support specialist and really not get any of it, right? Where to me, peer support is literally just about seeing people and holding folks and being in space with folks, and yet we don't always do that. And a part of that goes to the training component. Part of it just goes to the workspaces. Part of it just goes to us as individuals, right? When we walk in with our own biases and our own conditionings and all of that, we make it as part of the field. And there's a reason that peer support has assimilated so well within the larger medical industrial complex. And to me, those are really critical conversations to have. as we work through, like, what is that individual responsibility? What is the individual responsibility based on who you are? And always bringing it back to like that infrastructure, and then also like the power building, right? Where it's interesting of like how a lot of advocacy trainings don't really cover how do you build power, right? But to me, like, advocacy is power. It's, you're learning how to utilize your power in the ways that make the most sense. And so there's definitely a lot of different steps to it, right? Where folks need to recognize that, oh, actually, I want to be showing up more when it comes to these spaces. And then I now know how to build power, right? And how to show up properly. And also there's this infrastructure, right, that's holding me as I'm doing all of this. And for me, it's kind of similar to those three buckets from earlier. It's all necessary, right? It needs to happen. And I hold hope that we will get there, because why not?
Yeah, I'm with you. With everything that you said, I think this idea that like every way of providing peer support is right and okay, and that this is just a space to do whatever we want, is something that I just really think is something that the workforce really needs to confront itself on and reflect on. Of like, if we're saying that peer support is a model that's supposed to be doing all these different things, it can't be everything. Mm-hmm. I remember a couple of years ago, after George Floyd was murdered, I was asked to be on a panel that was specifically about how peer support can address racism in behavioral healthcare systems. And it was me and a couple of folks who were Black. And we just got on the panel and we're like, it can't. Like, this, it's just, this is, because it was being presented as like, this is the silver bullet to end racism in behavioral healthcare system. And we had to be like, there's a role to play here. But peer support, to your point of like, it's the be all end all. I hear that so frequently from the workforce still. Of like, it can solve all these problems, it can do all these things, but not without additional learning and growth and education. And as you were speaking, it made me think of, we spoke with Zay Okoronta, one of our other facilitators, who was talking about quote-unquote crisis. And I really appreciated an idea they put forward, that, you know, education isn't punishment. Having to learn more and maybe do better and understand other folks more deeply is not a punishment or saying that you're kind of bad or wrong. It's just a recognition that there's maybe room for growth here. And I hear that really within what you were talking about as well. Something I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on too is kind of in this advocacy space and in advocacy trainings and spaces. And as I hear, you know, folks talk about how do we grow and build the peer workforce and get what we want from these systems and go into these spaces, there's such a strong focus on, and you didn't talk about this really, but there's a very strong focus on like systems legitimized advocacy, that it's only really effective advocacy if we're doing it in the way and through the channels that the system has created for us. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on like, where does protest fit into all of this? Where does rebellion and revolution fit into all of this when we're talking about building advocacy skills?
I love that question. And I feel like it's a really basic answer of like, if the system is telling you how you could advocate, then like, it's no longer really advocacy, right? Like, the whole purpose of advocacy is to really go into that system change, system transformation, building alternative systems, right? It's really into the building power and all of that. And I would love people to be really wary of what are the areas that the system is giving you permission to actually do that work in. It doesn't mean like don't do that, right? Like, but also it's almost like a compromise, right? And to me, I've been thinking about this for years, right? Of who has the privilege to compromise, right? Because it's not usually the most marginalized of the most marginalized, right? It's usually a person in a position of power, which as a peer support specialist, we are in positions of power, regardless of how small of power we're working with. And so with that, we're basically compromising, right, on behalf of the rest of our community, which is never our place to be compromising for anyone or anything without the community being like, hey, okay, cool, we can accept this. And I think this is why I always go back to that infrastructure building, right? Of things like unionizing. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. but like, right? But where you're building some more systemic power, where right now it's basically individuals against an entire system, right? And I love how much power we can have as individuals. And also, right? That doesn't add up, right? That's not a one-to-one system. That's not an area where we can actually compromise equitably and in a way that makes sense. And we don't necessarily have to build infrastructure that's just as powerful. However, it can't just be single individuals at a time for all of these different things. Yeah. And so I always go back to the infrastructure building, because I think for me, that's really when we're starting to get more into like the system transformation. And even with the building alternative systems, it's really rare to find sustainable alternative systems, right? I can talk about dozens and dozens of examples that I've worked with that are wonderful for a while, right? But the pressure is a lot, right? Without any kind of additional support from like all areas in like the weirdest of ways, where it's not even related to the system at times, right? But it's just, there's gaps everywhere. And so the more infrastructure building that we do, the better. And part of building infrastructure at times is also going into that protest and the rebelling and all of that. I don't know if folks think about this often, but I guess I do. So with transformation in general, there's what I call like transformation windows. I don't know what other people have called it. But I'm sure others have been talking about this for like generations. But basically, whenever something big happens, it kind of like the start of COVID, right? For example, right? It opens a transformation window because everyone's freaking out and no one knows what to do. There are no answers. And whenever people have no answers is actually transformative, like a transformation window, right? Same with contradiction. So if we get on a call and we're all like, no, actually peer support is meant to be racist. And someone is like, no, peer support should not be racist, right? Like those contradictions build space for transformation. And that to me is part of that advocacy work that needs to happen, and that power building and that understanding of how do you like utilize those transformation windows to actually move things forward? Because what you can do during a transformation window is so much more than what you could do any other time, because you've gotten rid of so much of the resistance in that moment in time. Again, such as when COVID started, right? Like everything was possible, basically. But most people don't know how to recognize those transformation windows or how to utilize them. And we don't have the infrastructure to go and be like, okay, actually, like, let's look at the next 5 years. Like, when are the next transformation windows? Because they exist. Like, they could be, like, astrologists have been mapping out, like, transformation windows for, like, thousands of years, right? Like, it's not that hard to do. And also, we don't have any space to take that step back, right? Both in terms of like leadership within the peer workforce or as just peer support specialists doing this work, to really intentionally like dig deep together and be like, okay, let's actually talk about like, well, what happens in the next election, right? Like what happens during the next hurricane season, right, in the South? What happens during the forest fire season in California that starts in a few months, right? Like all of these things are, we know they're going to happen. We can probably like accurately determine exact dates for most of them. And also I find most spaces don't have space for that and capacity to really do that. And so, but if we did, then we could be like, okay, cool. So like, if we're going to be rebelling, let's do it around the elections, right? Or let's do it around this thing. If we're all going to come together and actually expand in the like building alternative systems, cool. Let's look at what else is happening and let's build something specific for that, right? Where we're all going to be engaged together and make it happen and then expand it from there, or just build a bunch of it, right? Everywhere versus just one large conglomerate, which I'm never really a fan of. But again, we don't necessarily have that infrastructure to have that space. And That's work I'm always really excited about, and I try to do in other spaces. But this kind of goes back to the community piece, where personally, I do that with the queer and trans Muslim community, right? The peer support specialists within that in particular. And if not that, then other queer and trans peer support specialists across the world versus the broader community, which is something I used to do years and years ago, as some people might know.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense. And I just really wanted to make sure that that piece got included, because I think the longer that we see peer support as a legitimized kind of quote unquote professionalized service existing within these systems, the further and further and further I see us moving away from our historical roots, and the less and less willing I see folks being willing to engage in anything besides systems approved advocacy channels. And I think that's been a struggle within the workforce to talk about, like, well, when is it time for us to reclaim some of that power and say, actually, no, we're, you, to your point, potentially about unionizing, like, we're not going to go to work until we get better wages.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, you know, even that you kind of said, like, I don't know if I can even say that, like, in a space like this, because that's a very real thing, right? That's something that we've had to talk about internally as a center, like, what can we do to support that? Can we support it? What language do we have to use about it? And I think that that is really a space where there is a lot of advocacy that's needed, because something that I hear a lot is, you know, folks want higher wages. And so kind of the historical response has been that we're going to train individual organizations one at a time about maybe where to get some extra funding or support one specific individual in advocating for a raise. But to your point, who knows what then happens to the next person when they bring those wages back down or when that grant funding runs out. And so what are our options as a workforce to collectively regain some of that power, potentially through unionization? Because going employer by employer by employer is not going to fix anything for anyone. You know, not at least at the sort of scale that people are saying that they want to see.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to hear your thoughts too. I appreciate everything you've had to say about how we just really don't necessarily have the existing infrastructure to advocate at the level that we maybe could to be most effective. I'm curious, when you envision that, you know, if you were envisioning what that infrastructure could look like, what do you see? What do you think that we could do?
I mean, everything. I think some work has already kind of started or has been happening for a little while, right? So you have like an APS, right? The National Association of Peer Supporters and things like that, that has really tried to capture a little bit of like the concerns of like the workforce and creating tools and some literature and things like that. To really be able to respond to some things. With that said, I think what really, in terms of infrastructure, I always look to the most marginalized of the most marginalized to really build it and everyone else to support that. Whenever the most marginalized of the most marginalized go and build something, it's accessible to everybody. But whenever the more privileged build something, it's exclusionary to everybody with any more marginalization than the folks at the table. And this is not necessarily a critique of some of the amazing work that's already happened within the peer support movement. But I will say of so much of what we currently have in terms of any kind of infrastructure was built by the most privileged of the most privileged within our peer support community. Right. And so to me, building that infrastructure would kind of be really trying to shift that, right? And it could be the like same organizations, same spaces, same lots of things, but really begin kind of and this is why I like building alternative systems versus just transforming systems, because you could take all of those organizations and just really change, like really bring in the most marginalized and the most marginalized into those spaces. However, what usually happens is the individuals from the most marginalized communities that are able to come forward are the ones who are already accepted by that, the more privileged of the group. And so it basically maintains the status quo, because you just try to add more and more people who agree with you or who are going to push you towards what you're more comfortable with, right? Like, it's really rare to be able to be in a space and just be like, all of you are wrong. And again, I love saying that from a kind and loving space where I can tell people they are wrong and also, okay, cool. And like, let's fix it, right? But you're wrong. We need to acknowledge that and then we can begin moving forward. But for me personally, I've amassed a decent amount of power due to my circumstances. And so I have the privilege to go into spaces and say that, and no one around that table can fire me, right? Or make me lose out on my entire income or blacklist me from other organizations and things like that. And those are all things that happen within peer support spaces that we don't talk about, right? We don't talk about the amount of repercussions that could exist for people to really speak their minds and say things. And so the alternative would be just building alternative systems, right? And with that, to me, like, some of the basics is just who owns all training? Who owns like our stories? Who owns our research? Who owns our spaces even, right? Like, who owns all of these different things? And as we're able to own more and more and more of those things, and by we, I mean the most marginalized of the most marginalized within the peer support community, right? We're able to slowly begin building that infrastructure. Because right now there are some really wonderful people doing some peer support research, and also most are not peer support specialists, right? Most are... I actually don't know very many that would not be white and cis, right? Like, and fairly affluent in terms of power building, right? In terms of our stories, right? It's always so hard to recommend to people a book about peer support, right? Because there's a bunch of different things, but all the ones I enjoy are not listed as peer support, quote unquote, right? Because they're mostly written by like Black women and Black trans folks and Indigenous folks, right? Who don't use that language, right? But it's the exact same model. Whereas trying to look up like an introductory 101, what is peer support in terms of like what I view peer support as, is so hard to find. even just like webinars and things like that are so hard to get. And like an accurate like history of peer support and just support in general and all of that. I usually have to go into like decolonized work and decolonized spaces for those things. But all of those things would not be seen as peer support within the broader peer support community. Right. And so how do we make sure that we're also building those things? How do we share our own stories in the way that we want to? In a larger scale. And then again, how are we coming together? How are we owning our spaces and the types of communities that we have? And it's always interesting for me where there's always a conversation of like the limitations of funding. And also like, and I've been having a lot of conversations about this with like queer and trans Muslim spaces, right? Of if every single queer and trans Muslim organization paid $40 an hour, funders will always give us $40 an hour. However, if I pay $45 an hour, but another queer and trans Muslim organization goes and pays $12.50 an hour to their employees, funders are going to pay $12.50 an hour, right? And then I will have to go and have a lot of conversations with them and be like, let's talk about this, right? But if everyone is paying $40 an hour, funders are going to pay $40 an hour, right? And so it's those things that are... they're seen as little, right? They're seen as small steps, but they're all just really critical in really moving forward. And I guess two final things that I'll mention. I do like to talk a lot. And so two final things is one in terms of like governance of spaces, right? Like as you're building infrastructure, it is so critical to understand how like structure of spaces could lead to the ingraining of systems of oppression within everything that we do. And that's an area that most people don't really recognize. And I've seen a lot of places where they move from a hierarchical model to more of a consensus model, which sounds really cute. And also I hate it. I like it more than structural model sort of, but the reason for that is because what a true equitable model is basically honoring that, and say there's three of us here, every single person here has an area of expertise, right? We are here because we matter in whatever ways that we choose to, right? And so whenever I say something that's in my area of expertise, in my lived experience that nobody else has, why would it be anybody else's place to be like, actually, I disagree with that, right? Maybe I should have a vote on this as well. And it's like, no, you do not get an opinion because it's not part of your lived reality, right? You don't have this wisdom. And I find with consensus models, instead of honoring everyone, we actually dishonor everybody involved. Nobody gets centered, nobody gets honored. And we pretend as if everyone knows everything. And it's like, no. And also, I don't want to know everything. I don't want to have an opinion when it comes to something that is completely outside of my purview. And then the second thing is just back to training for a second. Because, and this is where I go into like, who owns our training? Because, so we have a lot of like state legislature that's changing up training, right? There's that conversation about the national training. And then also you have an immense plethora of peer support training that exists within the alternative systems that have been built, right? Every organization kind of has their own, which is great. Because some of them do a really great job. And also, it also means that some of them really don't do a great job whatsoever. And even when it seems as if they are, it's not necessarily the case, but they can supplement it with a lot of other things. And it, I think there's this belief that training is, and I think this is most people's just lived experience, of most of us have never been to a really good training. Right? Like a transformative training. And like, to me, it doesn't matter if you're in a space for 8 hours or for 80 hours or 200, like any space can be transformative. And that's not currently happening. And this is not shade towards any other facilitators and things like that. However, when you look at the vast majority of people facilitating peer support training, they're not representative of the peer community, and they're not necessarily representative of the most marginalized and the most marginalized within the peer community, right? And so, and I say this for a lot of really, really, really wonderful people who at time would have been that transformative force, but today might not necessarily be that, because like whenever I walk into a space, and I've mostly trained within rural communities, and I love training rural communities, because from the very beginning, everyone's going to be confused by everything that I am, right? And it's just going to be chaos, and no one's going to know how to pronounce my name. No one's going to really know what like pronouns are and mean and all of that. But because of that, like from the beginning, we're going to talk about things, right? We're not going to try to ignore things and like move around things. And like, it just like, okay, like if we're going to be in this room for 2 weeks together, right? Let's go there. And people go there and people get to where they need to go, right? Literally within a couple of days, right? Because it becomes that transformative space. And it's not even something that I do. It's literally just, you throw me into a room. I don't even need to talk, right? Like you could just have me travel around as like a puppet or something. And that's enough for a lot of spaces. And so, but that doesn't normally happen, right? Most people won't get a trans displaced Indigenous Palestinian who's not a U.S. citizen and has experience with being a refugee and immigrant and has lived in 10 countries and a bunch of other things and is also an engineer for some weird reason and like just all the things. It's just chaos, and chaos is transformative, right? But if you bring somebody who looks exactly like everyone in the room, right, who identifies exactly as everyone in the room, they're like, there's no room for equity. Like we could talk about it. Like, I guess you could talk about white fragility and be like, let's talk about this. But it doesn't really move anywhere because it's hypothetical. It's all theory. And that point when like we're training people to be working with people, right? Like when you're done training on a Friday, people could be with others on Monday morning, right? And like, that could be someone who looks completely different than them, who identifies completely different than them. And if that's never come up in the training, then like, how are people going to be prepared? That transformation window just does not exist within that space. And so I'm always kind of mindful of that as well. And so really thinking of that, of who's developing the trainings, who's facilitating the trainings, who's in contact with people. And that's without even going into like the workforce itself, right? Because supervision is a thing that we should be talking about, but that's a different conversation.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Yafa. I think I'm again in total agreement with everything you said. I think I know I recently have experienced some of those same kind of issues you're talking about with training and certification processes and yeah, the opportunity for those spaces to truly be transformative. I think to your earlier point, I've only been to one training in my life that was truly, that I still look back on as like, this changed the way that I show up, the way that I do my job, the way that I am engaging with people and facilitating. There's only one. And it was not my peer certification training, even though that one's also great. But I think that that is such a great point of like, we need more than just kind of, are we sitting in this space together and talking and being here, but are we really being transformed by the spaces that we're in and a part of and the communities that we work within? I just want to say a big thank you to you. I love working with you. Anytime that I get the chance to collaborate, I'm very excited. So I appreciate everything that you've had to say today. And I hope that the workforce really benefited from your advocacy trainings and walks away from this conversation as well with some new ideas to ruminate on and think on and reflect on. So I just wanted to say a big thank you to everything you contributed to this project and for this conversation today.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure. It's such a great time.
Thank you for connecting with us, listeners. Our goal in sharing stories and information is to provide hope and resources to the field of peer recovery. Please join us again next month on Recovery Talk. You can find our episodes on our website, peerrecoverynow.org. That's peerrecoverynow.org, or wherever you find your podcasts. The Peer Recovery Center of Excellence is funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to enhance peer recovery support services by expanding access to training and technical assistance services across the country. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official policies of the Department of Health and Human Services, nor does mention of trade names, commercial practices, or organizations imply endorsement by the U.S. government. Talk with you next time.